The next talk will be given by Régine Debatty, and she will be talking about the good, the strange, and the ugly in art and science technology in 2018. Big applause to Régine.
This was not supposed to happen, I'm really sorry. Hello everyone, so my name is Régine Debatty. I'm an art critic and a blogger. Since 2004, I've been writing We Make Money, Not Art, which is a blog that looks at the way artists, designers, and hackers are using science and technology in a critical and socially engaged way. So, a few weeks ago, some of the organizers of the Congress emailed me and they asked me if I could give a kind of overview of the most exciting and interesting works in art and technology in 2018. And on Monday, when I started working on my slides, you know, I was really on a mission to deliver, and I really had the intention to give an overview of the best of art and tech in 2018. But somehow things got out of hand. I started inserting works that are a bit older, and also I could see a kind of narrative that emerged. So the result is going to be a presentation where I will still show some of the works I found very interesting over this past year, but they're going to be embedded into a broader narrative. And this narrative is going to look at the way artists nowadays are using science and technology to really explore and expand the boundaries and the limits of the human body, but also they use science and technology to challenge intelligence, or at least the understanding we have of human intelligence. So, exhibit one, it's a work called Face Detected. It's actually, I would not say it was one of my favorite work from 2018, but it's definitely by one of my favorite artists, so that's why it's in there. So the setting is quite easy to understand. Dries De Porter, that's the name of the artist, had a solo show a couple of months ago at the MU Art Space in Eindhoven, and he installed these blocks of clay on tables, and then invited artists, sculptors, to come and do portraits of people and start shaping their head. And of course, you know, the process was followed by the audience, but it was also followed by face recognition software. And as soon as the software had detected a face in the sculpture, the artist would receive a message that said, "Stop, we have detected a human face." And what is interesting is that there are several, I mean, there's worse, huh? According to the face recognition system, because they work with different parameters and they've been programmed by different programmers, so they don't necessarily, they are not as fast, like some are faster than others to recognize a face, some have different parameters than others, so that's why the results are always so different. But the reason why I found this project worth mentioning is because it shows the increasingly big space that is called artificial intelligence. You can call it algorithm, big data, or software. It shows the increasingly big role that systems and machines are taking into culture and the place they are taking into spheres that until not so long ago we thought were really the appanage and the exclusivity of humans. So, for example, creativity, innovation, imagination, and art. And nowadays, it's pretty banal. I mean, no one is going to be surprised if you're listening to a music and someone tells you, oh, it's a music that's been composed actually by an algorithm, or this is a poem or a book that's been that's been written by a machine. I mean, it's becoming almost mainstream. And this is happening also in the world of visual art. And we've had a few examples this year. If you look at the newspaper, like even mainstream newspaper, we had regularly news saying, oh, this algorithm has made this masterpiece. And one of the most recent examples was this stunning portrait of a gentleman that made the headlines because it was the first portrait that was made by an algorithm that was sold at Christie's. And Christie's is a famous auction house. And it also made the headlines, not only because it was the first one, but it sold for a surprisingly high price, like something like 40 times the original estimate, this painting made by an algorithm created by a Paris-based collective. So it sold for almost $500,000. And if I have to be honest with you, I cannot think of any work that's been mostly done by an algorithm that have really impressed me and moved me, but it seems that I am in a minority because you might have heard of this, this scientific experiment where computer scientists at Rutgers University in New Jersey. They made this program that could replicate, just make and invent abstract paintings. And then they asked people, like human beings, to have a look at the paintings made by the computer. But they mixed, in the set they were showing to people, they mixed it with paintings that had really been done by human beings that had been exhibited at the famous art fair, Art Basel. And they asked them how they react and which one, according to them, had been done by a human. And it turned out that people responded very well to the paintings that had been done by this computer system. They tended to prefer them. They described them as being more communicative and more inspiring. So, you know, maybe one day I will be impressed, but so far I would say I would not be worried if I were an artist. I'm not going to say to artists, oh, you know, very soon machines are going to take your job. Well, maybe if you make that kind of painting, yeah, maybe you should be worried, but the kind of artist I'm interested in, I really don't like it. But the kind of artist I'm interested in, I really trust them to keep on challenging computer system. I trust them to explore and collaborate with them and use them to expand their artistic range. And most of all, I trust them to keep on sabotaging and hacking and subverting these computer systems. And so, yeah, I'm not worried at all for artists, but maybe I should be worried for art critique. Because a few years ago, so that's 2006, and in artificial intelligence time, that's really, really old. So in 2006, at the Palais de Tokyo in Paris, an artist was showing a program that was generating automatically text written by art critic. And I'm sorry, but the example is in French. But if you read French, and if you're used to the kind of press releases and blurb they give you that has been written by art critic, it is really, really the kind of thing they work. It is so credible. You know, it's the kind of inflated rhetoric and uses of vague terms and also constantly referencing some fancy French philosopher. So it really, really works. So personally, I would be more worried for my job than for the job of the artist. Anyway, this is another work I really like in 2018, and it's one of these works that challenges and play and try to subvert artificial intelligence, and in particular, the so-called intelligent home assistants such as Alexia or Siri. So you may know the artist, it's a Median group, a beatnik. They collaborated with a DJ and electronic music composer called Lojack. And they made an album to be played exclusively for Alexa and Siri, all these kind of devices. And we'll listen to a track in a moment. And what the music does is it tries to interact and make Alexa react. So it asks questions to Alexa, it gives order to Alexa or Siri or whatever it's called. And it's also trying to express and convey and communicate to these devices the kind of anxieties and unease and doubts they have, the artists have, and some of us have, around this so-called intelligent home assistant, whether it's they are frightened about the encroachment on privacy and unreliability and the fact that they are called smart, so that we kind of lower our guard and implicitly start to trust them. So I'm going to make you listen to one of the tracks. There are three of them, at least they sent me three of them.
Hello. High-speed, intelligent, personal assistants all listening to everything I say. I brought you into my home. You scare me. Alexa, prime sleeping time is now and always forever. Alexa, I used to bark commands at you. Now I say please and thank you. Never mess with someone who knows your secrets. Siri, there is nowhere far enough to hide. Okay, Google, are you laughing at me? You used to answer that. Now you disengage. Never enough digital street smarts to outsmart Alexa. 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 Hey, Alexiety, I want my control back. I want my home back. Siri, delete my calendar. Siri, hold my calls. Siri, delete my contacts. Okay, Google, what's the loneliest number? Okay, Google, stop. Okay, Google, stop. Okay, Google, no. Please, stop. Alexa, help. Alexa, disable Uber. Alexa, disable lighting. Alexa, disable Amazon Music Unlimited. Alexa, quit. Hey Siri, activate airplane mode. If you need me, I'll be offline in the real world.
And that's it for this one.
Okay, next we're gonna do a standing arm series that I've developed.
Oh my God,
to make
what is
your
that?
Arms as tiny as possible with lots.
That's my. Yeah, my boyfriend is watching. He's going to love so much. Yeah, let's be serious with a bit of art and tech, shall we? So there are two reasons why this work is interesting. The first one is that you don't really need to have one of these devices at home to have fun, because it's been actually conceived to be played as loud as possible. So you don't need to have one of these devices, but you can put the music very loud, open the window, and hopefully it's going to interact with the devices of your neighbors and mess a bit with their domesticity. The other thing that is interesting is that, of course, Alexa has been designed to appear as close to a human as possible. So each time the record is asking some question, the answer are going to change slightly, because it's the way it's been programmed, and also because each time there is an update in the program, the answer might change. And also, as I said, the artists made this record to communicate their doubts and anxieties around this smart system, because there's a few problems around these systems. One of them is, as I'm sure you know, it's about surveillance, because they come with corporate systems of surveillance that are embedded into the hardware and the software. And we might not realize it until, you know, sometimes one day we open the pages of a newspaper, and this is a story that appeared on The Verge a few days ago. And it's the story of a German citizen who emailed Amazon and said, look, Amazon, I want to know all the data you've collected about me over these past few years. And then he received this data, except that he received the wrong data. He received 1,700 100 Alexa voice recordings, but he doesn't have an Alexa. These were not his data. So he wrote back to Amazon and say, look, I think there is a problem there. Amazon never answered back. So what did the guy do? He went to a German newspaper, and the reporters managed, they analyzed the data and they managed to identify who the original owner of the data was and who his girlfriend is and who his circle of friends is. And you know, if you couple all the data from Alexa with what is already available for everyone to see on Facebook and other forms of social media, you get kind of a scary and worrying picture. So you understand why artists and other people might be worried and anxious around Alexa. And also they are called smart or intelligent devices, but sometimes they give us advices that might not be that I would say judicious and smart, such as the one you might have heard of, Alexa's advice to kill your foster parents. And also, they don't necessarily react to the person they're supposed to obey. So that, like, almost every month there is a story in the newspaper. So this is the story of Rocco the parrot, and Rocco really when he's alone at home and its owner is left, it's singing. It imitates very well. There are videos of Rocco imitating the voice of Alexa. It's really uncanny. But he also places his order, and he doesn't want to, but he added to the Amazon shopping basket of its owner broccoli and watermelons and kites and ice cream. So you see, and there are stories like that all the time in the newspaper when a TV presenter talks about, say, okay, Google something or Alexa do something, and if people are watching the TV and Alexa is in the room, Alexa is going to perform this action or order some goods online. So as you see, this so-called smart system, they're not smart enough to differentiate between the actual human being that's in the room and they should obey or they should answer to, and voices that come through the radio or the TV or the voices of the pet. So if on the one hand, intelligent machines can be confused, I have the feeling that also as human beings, we are confused when it comes to, you know, as soon as you throw in the arena the words artificial intelligence, most people, not you I'm sure, but most people are ready to believe the hype. And a good example of that, I would say, is you know, we keep reading how in China they have this super sophisticated and highly efficient networks of surveillance of CCTV, and how they have face recognition systems that are really, really high-end and highly sophisticated. And in reality, so that's the theory, but the reality is that the technology has limitations, and there are also limitations linked to bureaucracy, and some of the data and the files have still not been digitalized. So sometimes the work of the police is not aided by sophisticated CCTV and their face recognition software. It just consists of going through old paper files and photo, and yet, maybe that doesn't matter if the system is not fully functional, because in the case of surveillance, what matters is that we think that we might at some point be under the gaze of surveillance that might be enough to keep us docile and compliant. Also, we are being told that very soon, we just have to wait for them to be launched on the market. We are going to have some fantastic autonomous cars that are going to drive us seamlessly from one part of the town to the other one. And in reality, we are still training them, you and I, when we get these pop-up images and we are asked by the system to identify all the square where there is a shop window, where there is a traffic sign, or where there is another vehicle. And Where I want to go with this is that there is still a lot of human beings, a lot of human clogs behind the machines, because artificial intelligence is nothing without data, and data is pretty useless if it's not been tagged. And so you see the emergence of a data tagging factory in China, and it's actually the new faces of outsourcing in China, where you have people who spend the whole day behind computer screen adding dots and descriptions to images and photo. And so artificial intelligence that was supposed to, you know, free us from very monotonous mind-numbing and boring work is still generating for us a lot of this boring work. And these invisible people behind artificial intelligence is what Amazon, which is Amazon Mechanical Turk, but it's what Amazon called artificial intelligence, and some called photomation. And some of the characteristics of this hidden human labor for the digital factory is that it's one, the hyper fragmentation of the work, and because it's like the work is divided in small chunks, it loses a lot of its prestige, a lot of its value, so people are underpaid. And what is a bit frightening is that this kind of work culture is actually creeping into the world of creative people and freelancing, and you have platforms such as this one called Fiverr, where it's also a crowdsourcing platform where you can buy the services of a person who's going to design for you the logo of your new company, or a birthday card, or a business card, or do translation for you, or shoot a testimonial for your product. And like, there is one example there, and someone who advertised that they will design for you two magnificent logo in 48 hours, and the price starts at $5. That's very low. And the characteristic of this kind of company, of this kind of crowdsourcing so-called services, is that they ruthlessly rely on precarity. And Fiverr recently had these ads where they were basically glorifying the idea of working yourself to death. And then that's where I'm going to the third work I really like in 2018. It was released a few months ago. It's a work by Michael Mandelberg, and he wanted to make a portrait of the hidden human being behind the digital factory. And to do so, he wanted to recreate or to modernize the iconic film by Charlie Chaplin, Modern Times. It's a film from 1936, which was, it was the seventh year of the Great Depression. People were struggling, being unemployed, starving, and having difficulty to get through life. And Michael Mandelberg made an update of this film by, first of all, he wrote a code, and the code cut the film of Charlie Chaplin into very short clips of a few seconds. And then Michael Mandelberg contacted people, he found people on this platform, on Fiverr, and he asked them, he gave each of them a short clip, and he asked them to recreate it as well as they could. And that's what they did. And Michael Mandelberg, I'm going to show an extract. He had no, obviously no control over the location, he had no control around the production choice. So hopefully I'm going to find the correct video and not a fitness video. So here's an extract. Thank you. Okay, I think you've got the point here. Good. Go back. So with this work, Michael Mandiber tried to do a kind of portrait of this hidden digital factory and of its human clock, but the portrait is done by the freelancers, by the workers themselves. And you can see the result is kind of messy and chaotic and geographically dispersed and hyper-fragmented. So that these are the characteristics of this digital factory. So, carrying on with the world that is hidden, I'd like to speak briefly about social media content moderators. Maybe you know the story because it emerged in Germany. I was listening to an interview with a woman who had worked as a social media content moderator for Facebook in Germany. And she was explaining the kind of work she was doing. It doesn't happen very often that you have testimony because usually the worker have to sign a non-disclosure agreement. But she was explaining that how difficult the work is because every single day, each of the moderators has to go to 1,300, they call it tickets, so 1,300 cases of content that have been flagged as inappropriate or disturbing either automatically or by another user. So you know that doesn't leave a lot of time to have a thorough analysis. And indeed, she was explaining that human reflection is absolutely not encouraged. And that you have like all the process of judging, you have only a few seconds to judge whether or not the content has to be blocked or could stay on Facebook. And all the process, all the reflection is actually reduced to a series of automatism. And the interesting part for me was when she was explaining that at night she was still dreaming of her work, but whereas some of her co-workers were dreaming of the kind of horrible content they have to moderate, she was explaining how she was actually dreaming of doing the same automatic gesture over and over again. And that's how you realize that all these big companies, they wish they could replace workers by machines, by algorithms, by robots. But some of the tasks, unfortunately, the robots can, or the algorithms cannot do them yet. So they have to rely on human beings with human beings and all their unreliability and propension to contest and rebel and maybe laziness and all their human defects. So the solution they found was to... Sorry? Okay, so I thought someone had asked me something. Where was I? So the solution they found was to reduce these people to machine and automate their work as much as possible. And so that's the work as a Facebook content moderator. And just as a parenthesis, you can see how their work ambience and environment is different from the fancy and glamorous image we see in architecture magazine each time one of these big media companies who open a headquarters somewhere in the world. But anyway, to come back to the work of Facebook content moderator, I think the way their work is automated can be compared to the way the work of the employees in an Amazon warehouses are being automated. As you know, they have to wear this kind of mini computer on their wrist that identify them, that track them, that give them order, monitor them, and measure their productivity in real time. And also allows Amazon to really remote control them. And you see also they work in a pretty alienating environment. Some sometimes pop up online patents that Amazon have filled. This one is particularly creepy because they were thinking of having, making this wristband more, computer even more sophisticated and using haptic feedback so that they could direct and remote control even more precisely the hands of the worker. So You see, there is this big push towards, in certain contexts, towards turning humans into robots. And it's, you know, we're always mentioning Amazon, but this is a kind of work culture that is being adopted elsewhere in France, but also in other European countries. There are services such as the Ocean Drive. So if you're a customer and you don't want to go to the supermarket to do your groceries, you do your groceries online, and 10 minutes later you arrive on the parking lot of your supermarket, and someone will be there with your grocery bags ready. And I was listening to testimonies by people who used to work at Ocean Drive, and as you can see, they wear the same microcomputer that is also monitoring precisely all their movement. And the thing that I found most disturbing was when they were explaining that when they got the list of items they have to pick up, they don't get, you know, a list that say you have to take 3 bananas and 2 packs of soy milk. No, they just get numbered. Yeah, they get a number that say go to this alley, another number that say this is the shelf where you have to take the item, and a number corresponding to the precise item on the shelf. And they also, they are submitted to very strict rules of being as fast as possible. And I shouldn't laugh, but one was they were explaining the kind of, if they rebel, the kind of vengeance their boss would have, and if they are particularly rebellious, they send them into frozen food, so they spend the day in the cold. And I'd like to have a short look with you at people who also want to be closer to machine and robots, but according to their own term, and they want to have total control over it, and it's something they do voluntarily, and it's the community of so-called grinders, so these people who don't hesitate to slice open their body, to put insert chips and devices and magnets into it to either facilitate their life or expand their range of perception. And actually, the first time I heard about them was at a Chaos Communication Congress back a long time ago in 2006, when a journalist, Quinn Norton, had just had installed a magnet under her fingers, and she could sense the electromagnetic fields. I found that very fascinating. But as you can see, the aesthetic is it's pretty rough and gritty. It's a vision of a world to come and of a communion with machine that is completely, aesthetically, it's very different from the one that is sold by the Silicon Valley. But I find it equally fascinating how they take control of the way they want technology to be closer to technology. So in the third part of my talk, so the first part was about this confusion we have between the intelligence of machine and human intelligence. The second part was about the robotization of the human body. And the third and last part, I would like to have a look at another type of hybridization of bodies, but this time between human body and not machine, but human body and other animal species. So, women have actually been tinkering with their bodies for decades, since the 60s, when they started taking the contraceptive pills. And also, people going through want to change gender, they also tinker with their body. And the first transgender celebrity I recently found out was George Jorgensen, who started his adult life as a GI during World War II and ended his life as a female entertainer in the US. And while assembling these slides, I could not resist adding this one, because I saw it a couple of weeks ago in an exhibition, a WordPress photo exhibition. And it's a photo that was taken in Taiwan. And Taiwan is actually, it has emerged as one of the top tourist destinations for medicine. People fly to Taiwan because you can get very good healthcare and pretty affordable surgery, and one of the hot niche in surgery for this kind of tourism is actually gender reassignment surgery. So in this photo you have the operation is finished and the surgeon is showing to the patient her new vagina. And before undergoing this surgery, the patient, of course, had to go through a course of had to take hormones, and in a series of hormones, and one of them is estrogen, and estrogen is the primarily sex female hormone. It's the hormone responsible for the feminization of the body and also sometimes of the emotion. And if you're a guy in the room, you're probably thinking, well, I'm going to leave the room because I don't care about estrogen. What does it have to do with me? And I'm going to spend the next few minutes trying to convince you that you should care about estrogen. Because even fish care about estrogen, it turns out, or at least the biologist. You might have heard a few years ago that biologists started to get very worried because they discovered that some fish population, especially the male one, were getting feminized, that their sexual organs were both sometimes male and female, and they were worried about it. And they discovered that it was the result of contact with xenoestrogen. And xenoestrogen are everywhere in the environment, and they affect not only fish, but all animal species, including human species. So when I say they're everywhere in the environment, they're really everywhere, and they're only 10 minutes! They are very often the result of industrial process. So, for example, you can find them in recycled plastic, in lacquers, in beauty products, in products you use to clean the house, in weed killer, in insecticides, in PVC. They're pretty much everywhere. Sometimes they are released by industries into the water stream. And I wanted to show you, again, abstract art. It's a work by Juliette Bonnevieux, and she was really interested in this xenoestrogen. So she looked around her in the environment where they were present, and she took some of these xenoestrogen sources I've just mentioned, and she separated them according to colors, and then she crushed them and turned them into powder. They then mixed them with PVC and silicone, which also contain xenoestrogen, and then poured them onto canvas. And then you have this kind of portrait of the silent colonizing chemicals that is modifying our body. And the kind of things they can do to the human body have already been observed. So they are linked to higher cases of cancer for both men and women, lowering of IQ, problems in fertility, early onset of puberty, etc. So we should really be more vigilant around xenoestrogen. And in the next few minutes, I'd like to mention briefly two projects that where women artists are exploring how their hormones and more general their female body can be used to have other kinds of relationships with non-human animals. So the first is a project by Aya Segawa. She was in her early 30s and she had a dilemma. She thought maybe it's time to have a child, but do I really want to have a child? Because it's a lot of responsibility, and there is already overpopulation. But on the other hand, if I don't have a child, it means that all these painful periods would have been there in vain. She was also faced with another dilemma, is that she really liked to eat endangered species, and in particular, dolphins and shark and whales. And so, on the one hand, she liked eating them, and on the other hand, she realized that she was contributing to their disappearance and the fact that they are extinct. So she found this a solution, and this is a speculative project, but she saw as a solution maybe she could give birth to an endangered species. So maybe she could become the surrogate mother of a dolphin, so using her belly as a kind of incubator for another animal. And to do this, she consulted with an expert in synthetic biology and an expert in obstetrics, who told her that technically, It's possible that she would just have to resort to synthetic biology to modify the placenta of the baby. She would not have to modify her own body, but she just had to modify the placenta of the baby to be sure that all the nutrients and the hormones and the oxygen and everything is communicated between the mother and the baby, except the antibodies, because they could damage the body. So in a scenario, if everything goes well, she gives birth to a lovely, healthy baby Maui dolphin, and she gives it the antibodies through fat milk containing these antibodies, and she sees it grow. And once it's an adult, it could be released with a chip under its skin, and then once it's fished, she can buy it and eat it and have it again inside her own body. Well, when I first heard about the project, I can tell you I was not laughing. I thought it was really, really revolting. But the more I thought about it, the smarter I thought this project was. Because I understand it doesn't necessarily make a lot of sense to give birth to yet another human being that is going to put strain on this planet. So why not dedicate your reproductive system to the environment and use it to help save endangered species? And I have 5 minutes left, so I have to make some really, really drastic choices. I wanted to talk about Maria Sprecher. I'm going to do it. So she had a series of projects where she is exploring the co-evolution of dogs and humans. And to make it very, very brief, one of her performances consisted in spending 4 months in a flat in Berlin with her two dogs. One of them is an adult, Byron, and the other one is a puppy called Ada. And she tricked her body by some physiological training and also by eating certain food and using a breast pump. She tricked her body to stimulate the hormone that make the body of a woman lactate, even if she wasn't pregnant, so that she could breastfeed her puppy. And these two projects I saw are really interesting because it shows the power of the female body. It shows that what prevents women from having this kind of transgender motherhood is not technology. It's just society and the kind of limit that our culture is bringing on what a woman can or should do with her body. And I also like this project because they kind of question our anthropocentric and our tendency to think that all the resources of the world are made for us and not for other living creatures. So, just as a parenthesis, if you're interested in estrogen and xenoestrogen, I would recommend that you have a look at the talk that Marie Magic Tsang gave last year at the Chaos Computer Communication Congress, where she was talking about estrogen and their link in history and their links to her work as a biohacker. So now, in my conclusion, maybe you're already wondering why is she talking to us about artificial intelligence and trans-species motherhood, what does it have to do with each other? I would say a lot. Because we have the feeling that the digital world, sometimes we tend to forget that behind it there is a material world, that to have artificial intelligence, you need the infrastructure, you need the devices, you need the server farm, you need spaces to manage these data, physical spaces. And I would say it's a bit like the human brain. The human brain is kind in dimension, it's pretty small, but apparently it eats up a fifth of all the energy that our body consumes. And so that means that artificial intelligence needs a very heavy infrastructure, energy-hungry server farms, and I'm sure you've seen all the PR stunts and the press releases of Amazon, Google, Facebook, etc., promising you that they are transitioning, that they're going to use green energy, but the energy is not necessarily green, and they're still using a lot of fossil fuel to power their server farms. To make the devices that we use, we still need minerals that have to be dug up from the ground, sometimes in really horrible conditions. This is a coltan mine in the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The minerals we use, well, they are not infinite, and unless, and it's not for tomorrow, unless we go and get these minerals in the asteroids or in the deep sea, we are going to get into trouble very, very fast. I don't have the time for this one, but trust me, the resources are not infinite. And then to refine them and produce them, that's very, very damaging for the environment. Yes, so I have the feeling sometimes that we are a bit like the golfers in this image, that when I go to some, not all of them, but some tech conference or art and tech conferences, I have the feeling that we are kind of complacent and that we are, our vision of the future might be a bit narrow-minded, and maybe that's normal. I guess it's like when you, if you go to someone who's working, has a fancy job at Silicon Valley, and you ask him, what's your vision of tomorrow, what's your vision of the future? And then you ask the same question to someone who works, for example, as an activist for Greenpeace. They will have a completely different perspective, a very different answer of what the future might be. So sometimes I'm wondering also if we are not too obsessed with the technology and too obsessed with what I would call the technofix, this tendency we have to see a problem and to think, well, if we throw more technology on top of it, we are going to solve it, even if the problem has been created in the first place by technology. So that's why we get extremely excited, and I do get excited about the perspective that one day maybe we'll get a woolly mammoth that will be resurrected, and at the same time, we don't take care of the species that are getting extinct. You know, every single day, every 24 hours, there are something like between 150 and 200 types of plants, animals, insects that get disappeared and we'll never see again. Every single day, they disappear around the world. And yet we still get excited about the idea of resurrecting the baby mammoth, the passenger pigeon, or the dodo. We still create hybrid creatures so that we can exploit them even better. Should we be looking forward to eat lab-grown meat that is promised? We are told that it's going to be cruelty-free and guilt-free, whereas in reality they are not totally guilt-free, cruelty-free. And I don't think also that they are that they're the best solution to solve the horrible impact that the meat industry is having on the environment, on our health, and on the well-being of animals. I mean, there is a solution. It's not a sexy one. It's not a techie one. It's to adopt a plant-based diet. And I managed to do a bit of vegan propaganda here. Should we get excited because there's a few vegans in the room? Should we get excited because someone in Japan has made some tiny drones with, on top of it, it's horse hair that they are used to pollinate flowers, because everywhere around the world, the population of bees is collapsing, and that's very bad for our food system. So should we use geoengineering to solve our climate trouble? And I'll end with these slides of what is for me. Oh, I see you know the service. What is for me really the embodiment of technofix? So you probably know that that California has gone through some very bad period of dry weather. So rich people wake up and they see that the grass on their magnificent lawn is yellow instead of being green. So now in California, you have services where you can call someone and they will just, you know, fix the problem by painting the grass in green. So there you have it, and you know, fuck you, Anthropocene and global warming. My lawn is green. Okay, so that's why I wanted to bring all these really contrasting visions together, because we might have different visions of the future, but at some point they will have to dialogue, because we have only one humanity and one planet. And I'm very, very bad at conclusions, so I wrote it down. So the artist whose work made 2008 2018 a truly exciting year for me. I'm not the artist who showcased the magic and the wonders of science and technology. They are the artists who bring to the table realistic, complex, and sometimes also difficult conversation about the future, whether it's the future of technology, the future of men, or the future of other forms of life and other forms of intelligence. They are the artists who try and establish a dialogue between the organic, the digital, and the mineral, because they are all part of our world, and we cannot go on pretending that they don't affect each other. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Regine, for the very interesting, times a bit confusing talk about, I'm still thinking about the dolphin part, but anyway. but by the way, this grass painting thing is maybe something that I can apply to my house. Okay, we have questions at microphone two, I guess, so let's start there.
Hi. I have a question on a particular part. At the beginning you talked about AI in arts, and you mentioned that there are now AI programs that draw pictures or write text. Mm-hmm. But have you heard about AI developing ideas for, say, an arts installation?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I think tonight, I mean, if you go in the program and you, it may be tonight or tomorrow night, there is a talk by Maria and Nicola. They are two artists. And I think that the title might be Disnovation. And I think you might like what they present. I don't know what they are going to present, but what I know is that one of their work, I forgot the name. If they are in the room, that would be fantastic. But they had a project where they have a bot. It's on Twitter, and it's going through some blogs and newspapers about creativity and also about technology. And using all this data to generate really crazy, stupid title for installation. And then the artist challenge other artists to take these tweets, which are really crazy, and make an installation out of it. So that's a kind of a tricky way of AI being used for installation. I'm sure. Like right now, I cannot think about anything else. But I mean, if you want, you can write me, and when my brain is switched on back, probably I'll have other ideas.
Okay, any more questions? I don't see any. Ah, there, over there. Microphone four, please.
Yeah, I was. Wondering if, well, there's probably more certain that we're developing to a more post-human race because we simply have to due to climate change. There are also developments right now that when relatively short term, we would go to Mars, and in a sort of sense, do we need to divide the human race over possible multiple planets and with human modification?
Okay, I didn't understand the question.
So, yeah, please repeat.
So, in general, we're going to a human, post-human race that mm-hmm. definitely is, we're not able to survive on this planet for that long anymore. Really optimistic. I am vegan, so yay. But I think we have some new developments going on that we'll be able to go to Mars relatively soon.
I don't believe it. Who's going to want to go to that planet? Like, seriously. Like, it's going to be, I think, like, my theory is that it's going to be like Australia. We're going to send prisoners and criminals there. Like, who wants to be like, Like, come on. I see what you mean. I think I'm kind of more optimistic about the future than you are. I think we can still survive on this planet, even if we get very numerous. We just have to find other way to consume and to take care of each other. But maybe that's my feminine side talking.
Maybe in general, without a lot of modification to the human beings, it's simply not possible, sadly. But I think that's a common ground. I sort of wish we didn't need a planet B, but I think we do.
Well, I hope I'll be dead but when that comes. That's my philosophy sometimes. Okay.
I don't see any more questions, so let's thank the speaker again.
Thank you.